from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a breakthrough nuclear deal with Iran. Domestic terrorism in Chattanooga. Greeks bow to a bailout. The Republican field grows again. In Vienna, John Kerry lauded an Iran deal that's taking plenty of heat.
This is the good deal that we have sought. Believe me, had we been willing to settle for a lesser deal, we would have finished this negotiation a long time ago.
In Waukesha, Wisconsin, Scott Walker made it official, candidate number 15 in the GOP field of White House contenders. And he said, a fighter.
My record shows that I know how to fight and win. Now more than ever, America needs a president who will fight and win for America.
And in Chattanooga, Tennessee, 4 U.S. Marines dead in an attack that began at a local recruiting office.
He just pulled up, and next thing you know, he lifted up his arms with a big black gun, and just, it was one shot, and then it was just endless shots.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Crowley of Politico, Garance Frank Ruta of Yahoo News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us this hour. What's your take on the Iran deal on Greece, El Chapo, Chattanooga? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me back, Tom. Great to be here.
Great to have you. And from Washington, Garance Frankie Ruta is with us, editor-in-chief at Yahoo Politics. Garance, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Garance.
I don't know where to turn on Chattanooga. The news still fresh. The details still sketchy. I mean, the shooter is there and at this point dead. The eyewitness report still coming in. Here's another from CBS affiliate WDEF in Chattanooga.
He took a shot, and then it was a pause for about 2 seconds, and then it was just shot, 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 shot.
And here, U.S. Attorney Bill Killian saying domestic terrorism.
This is a sad day for the United States. These service members serve their country with pride, and they have been the victims of these shootings. We are conducting this as an act of domestic terrorism.
The shooter, Muhammad Yusuf Abdulaziz, dead himself now, out of Chattanooga, reports that his father had been investigated some years ago for potential links to terror organizations. Michael Crowley, do we have any clearer picture of what has really transpired here and why?
Tom, unfortunately, the picture remains blurry. You know, and we don't want to jump to conclusions because we've seen what happens. When we do, the conclusions are often wrong. You know, having said that, there are elements here that would be consistent with what may be one of, you know, what may be the top fear of Homeland Security, counterintelligence, and many law enforcement officials around the country, which is that, lone wolf Muslims who may be prone to radical ideology and maybe throw in potential mental health issues. There are reports that on a blog this individual kept, he wrote dark thoughts. He expressed dark thoughts about life being short and bitter, and also spoke of submitting to Allah. Now, that language, neither of those statements makes you an Islamic terrorist, but it would be consistent with the kind of person we have seen fall prey to what the FBI director James Comey called in the last couple of weeks, the devil sitting on the shoulder of a lot of, sort of disenchanted, discontented young men around the country, which is that Twitter stream coming into their phones from ISIS members and supporters saying, kill, kill, kill. If you can't come to Syria and fight, kill somebody where you live. Now, again, you know, I don't know that this is the theory, so I won't dwell on it for too long, but this is the concern. This is what they are investigating very carefully. But we just don't know. And, you know, it's possible this was just a severely mentally ill person. But the last thing I'll say is that the target, U.S. military service members, again, very consistent with that concern. So I'm afraid we may have one of these events on our hands, but we don't know yet.
Of course, we saw the death toll at Fort Hood not so many years ago. This young man out of a very prim suburb across the river from Chattanooga, we're told, We don't know the details yet, but we see the images, and they fit a kind of stereotype, maybe too easily, but we'll see over time. Garance, how do you see this playing out politically as this, what, four dead here, comes right into the early months of the presidential campaign season?
Well, I don't know that it's going to be a huge contributor to the presidential campaign season. Obviously, everyone condemns an act like this. I think there's unanimity of opinion on that. There'll be a lot of questions and speculation about where he was radicalized, whether that was online or whether that was through other individuals in the United States. And there'll be questions about the FBI, which has, you know, missed other terrorist acts against the United States in the past.
Jack, it's been kind of amazing the way the FBI has come up with people for just muttering unhappiness about the United States or sympathetic thoughts toward ISIS. And this time, apparently, no sign on this guy, and the bullets flew.
The bullets flew, something perhaps on his father, but some years ago. You know, Tom, let me just step back for a second. This comes the day the Colorado shooter is found guilty and weeks after the Charleston shooter did his worst. And this really gets to the sort of generic American story here. And The Economist put this imperishably. It wrote, "Those who live in America or visit it might do best to regard mass shootings the way one regards air pollution in China, an endemic local health hazard which, for deep-rooted cultural, social, economic, and political reasons, the country is incapable of addressing." That may be, however, a bit unfair. China seems to be making progress on pollution, The Economist writes.
So you're calling it generic and putting it in the same pot as the shootings in Charleston, as the big shooting in Colorado. I mean, each has its own coloring.
Each has its own coloring.
But each a young man with a gun and many dead in the wake.
Many dead in the wake, yes. And you know, this, and to connect it with terrorism, you know, people who are on the terrorist watch list can obtain firearms. And between 2004 and 2010, people on that list tried to buy guns or explosive 1,400 times. They succeeded 1,300 times. So ISIS could come over here and arm itself, and that would be under our laws.
John in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Thank you for calling, John. You're on the air.
I think that, you know, we had four Marines that were unarmed. This guy showed up, was able to kill all four of them. If they all four would have had handguns, they might have killed one or two people, but he probably wouldn't have killed four of them. He might have killed one or two, and then they would have shot and killed him. Having a person in uniform is a bullseye on your head anyhow, just because of the job they're doing and what we're doing in the world. And we shouldn't have anybody in uniform at all without a gun with clips full of ammo, just in case someone like him shows up.
Of course, I hear your point, John. It's hard to picture the whole country armed up like a military base, but even on a military base where the military is very familiar with the use of arms, they haven't wanted arms everywhere. I don't know if they could have responded in time or not, but we take the point, John, and I appreciate your call. I want to move to the big Iran deal. So much attention to this week. Such a long drumbeat of anticipation, and finally, there it was. Here was the president at his press conference on Wednesday saying this deal, the best way to ensure Iran doesn't get a nuclear weapon.
Without a deal, the international sanctions regime will unravel with little ability to reimpose them. With this deal, we have the possibility of peacefully resolving a major threat to regional and international security. Without a deal, we risk even more war in the Middle East.
And here this week, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking to lawmakers in Jerusalem. This was on Tuesday, speaking harshly about the Iran nuclear agreement. Netanyahu.
The world is a much more dangerous place today than it was yesterday. The leading international powers have bet our collective future on a deal with a formal sponsor of international terrorism.
And the echo of that in the United States, or maybe just homegrown. Senator Lindsey Graham, South Carolina, harshly criticizing the deal. MSNBC on Tuesday.
This is a terrible deal. It's going to make everything worse, and I really fear that we set in motion a decade of chaos.
Michael Crowley, you cover foreign affairs at Politico. Who's happy about what in Iran here? Who's happy about what in the United States? And what about the deal overall?
Yeah, Tom, I've lived this deal for a while now.
Yeah.
And I will say I'm very happy that, you know, there was some kind of resolution and not just another series of deadlines that were defining the summer of so many people like me.
Yeah.
So I would say to the first part of your question, who's happy in Iran is, you know, the president, Hassan Rouhani, and, you know, what we might call the moderates or the reformers. And, you know, essentially, you know, the last election in Iran produced a president and his foreign minister, who is a very familiar face, Javad Zarif, who was meeting directly with John Kerry all these days in Vienna and elsewhere, who essentially argued that it was time to, you know, change the stance of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, denying the Holocaust, being incredibly bellicose and hostile to the West, and try to talk to the West about Iran's nuclear problem with the goal of getting the sanctions on Iran's economy lifted. And this is a great success for that faction in Iran's very factional political system. I think it's important for people to understand that Iran's supreme leader is essentially a, you know, a religious ideologue, and Iran's military is extremely conservative and hardline. But there are moderate reformist factions, and this is a big victory for them. And I think this is the bet, part of the bet that President Obama is placing.
What about this on this deal, side, Michael? Just a minute before the break here or left.
Yeah, Tom, I apologize. And on this side, it's a huge victory for Barack Obama and John Kerry, who said, we can do this deal. Iran will agree. They're not just stalling for time. And so I think it's a big win for both Obama's legacy and John Kerry's legacy. But you've heard conservatives are very unhappy, as is Israel and our Sunni Arab allies.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news, the big Iran deal, of course, the Greek bailout, tough, tough deal there. El Chapo escaped from prison in Mexico. Scott Walker in the GOP field now, 15 contenders for the GOP nomination on that side of the ledger. Garant's Frankie Ruta is with us, editor-in-chief of Yahoo Politics. Michael Crowley is here, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What do you see in this Iran deal? Who's speaking to you on this? The president with his arguments? Benjamin Netanyahu with his arguments? Critics in the U.S. Congress, House, and Senate? The president saying, hey, you know, the options weren't great. Have you got a better idea?
Even if everything the critics were saying was true, that at the end of 10 years or 12 years or 15 years, Iran now is in a position to decide it wants a nuclear weapon, that they're at a breakout point. They won't be at a breakout point that is more dangerous than the breakout point they're in right now.
So push it down the road, but it won't be any more dangerous than it is right now, said the president. Critics, very tough. This was a Tuesday morning, MSNBC's Morning Joe, Republican Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas, who had one of those who sent a letter to Iranian leaders warning them off of a deal earlier this year, denounced the new deal in from Vienna.
This proposed deal is a terrible, dangerous mistake that's going to pave the path for Iran to get a nuclear weapon, while also giving them tens of billions of dollars of sanctions relief.
And just a couple more here. The Iranian foreign minister who talked with John Kerry for all those months, Javad Zarif, saying, hey, maybe it's a new day dawning.
This is a beginning to start a different type of relationship with the West.
A different type of relationship with the West. Hillary Clinton out on the campaign trail with her own careful words here. She got a little tougher later in support of the deal.
All in all, I think we have to look at this seriously, evaluate it carefully. But I believe, based on what I know now, this is an important step.
She got heat from Democrats for such a kind of nudgy endorsement there and came out with a printed statement. I support the agreement because it can help us prevent Iran from getting a nuclear weapon with vigorous enforcement, unyielding verification, and so on. Garant, Frankie Ruta, have you begun to count noses on Capitol Hill? Does this fly with the U.S. Congress? Does the Congress look like it could override a presidential veto if Congress moves to reject it?
I think at this moment in time, what we're going to be seeing is this falling out around traditional partisan lines. For the American public, at least, most people are going to look at this deal and say this is an extremely complicated thing. They're not going to take the time to read the actual deal. And even if they do, it's hard to know how to assess all of this without understanding Iranian politics and how you can trust the different actors involved. So I think people will look to their leaders fall in traditional partisan opinions on this, and we will see presidential politics absolutely coming into this as more hardline candidates condemn it. Congress has 60 days to review the agreement and then decide whether or not to approve or disapprove of the deal. Even if they pass a resolution of disapproval, Obama could then veto that, and then they would need a two-thirds majority to override that veto. If the Democrats continue to side with the president, that veto will not be overridden.
Michael Crowley, do you see enough Democrats open to going against the deal to threaten the president's and John Kerry's package?
Tom, I don't see enough Democrats right now turning against the deal in a way that prevents the president from being able to sustain his veto. In fact, I think, although it's unlikely, I think it's actually possible that there could be enough Democrats to filibuster a Republican expression of disapproval before we even get to the point of a veto. So that's kind of the first step here. That's sort of the first battle that will play out. That will require holding 41 or 45 Senate Democrats. I think that's going to be pretty hard. I don't think, unless, you know, we may learn that there is some poorly worded provision, some loophole, some bombshell may come, Iran, we may have some confrontation with Iran, accidental or not, in the region that changes the way people are thinking about this. But I think the way it's playing out right now, the Democrats will be there to sustain a presidential veto.
Jack Beatty, what have you seen in this whole long back and forth here? Such a long effort. John Kerry right in the middle of it, in the middle of that, what, he was on his bike ride and, you know, broken bones and joints and coming home and back and getting it done. Is this a deal that looks like a good deal to you, Jack? And what do you see behind it?
Well, let me just say a word about John Kerry. Michael, you know, talked about this as a sort of personal triumph for him. Bidding goodbye, you know, in Vienna to the negotiators, he choked up. And this is according to our friend David Sanger in the New York Times, when he spoke of going off to the Vietnam War as a young naval officer and returning, quote, committed to using diplomacy to avoid the horrors of war. These talks, on which he labored mightily, are thus in part a rare welcome legacy of Vietnam. According to a Kerry friend, his vote for the Iraq War in 2002 oppressed him practically from the moment he cast it. It was a political vote. To preserve his viability as a presidential candidate, he really betrayed his promise to himself. As the nominee in 2004, he couldn't hide his guilty conscience. At some level, one felt this high-minded but ambitious man must have regarded the swift boat smears that sunk him as condign punishment. Now in Vienna, he has finally pulled his divided self into unity. The deal may come undone through Iranian cheating. A Republican president may choose war to destroy the nuclear infrastructure that the deal does leave in place. But even then, even in that worst case, John Kerry can say with St. Paul, I have fought the good fight. I have finished my course. I have kept the faith, kept it with himself and with all who served and suffered in Vietnam.
Absolution from Jack Beatty there, no less. Ronnie in Abilene, Texas. Ronnie, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
Yes, sir. What do you think?
I think that it's the best idea Obama has come up with as far as diplomacy over war. You can't beat it. I mean, and they can fuss all they want about Iraq, but if anything goes wrong, we've got all kinds of inspectors and everything over there. We can put these sanctions that they're fussing back about immediately. We can put them back immediately. So it's, you know, it's better to take the chance that we can make the deal work than not have a deal at all. That's my first thing. My second thing would be this. On the stuff that's been happening around here as far as all the killings and the shootings and all that.
Yes.
Whether it's domestic terrorism or foreign terrorism, living in a free society, you give people opportunity to do wrong. You just have to trust in the justice system to bring justice to them afterwards. We cannot give up our freedom because we're scared. If you know, that makes no sense. It's the land of the free if we're brave.
Hey, I'm all for that, Ronnie. Let's look for justice as widely as we can find it in that system, maybe to help tamp down that violence at the same time. I appreciate your call. Michael Crowley, two issues that Ronnie raises there. One, war was the option. The president more or less said that in his press conference. That was his implication. And then the assertion that we could go back to sanctions, there I saw the president speaking the other way. He was saying sanctions are, you know, just about to come undone right now because we can't keep the whole international scheme going. What about war and sanctions at this point, Michael?
Yeah. So war is the alternative, sure has been the kind of ace in the hole for the administration. And, you know, you saw that argument rolled out back in the spring when the White House was trying to hold off the Congress from its threat to pass more sanctions that the administration said would blow up the talks. And, you know, part of that is mobilizing, liberal activist groups to amplify that message and, you know, pressure members of Congress, light up their phones with Democratic voters saying, you know, what are you doing? You're taking us to war again. For instance, MoveOn.org was a big part of that. So I think that's been a very powerful argument. It drives opponents of the deal absolutely crazy. They think it's a bad faith, unfair argument, at least many of them do. And that takes us to the next point, sanctions. You know, I do think that one of the stronger arguments on the other side, which is not to say it's the last word or the right argument, is the following. Some of the toughest sanctions against Iran really only kicked in late, I believe, 2013 and, you know, started to bite into 2014. Those were banking and financial sanctions passed by the U.S. Congress. And what you hear some of the opponents say is, you know, that's when you saw Iran's economy really start to blow up, fall apart, whatever metaphor you want, and that the pain was only recently starting to sink in. And, you know, we came to the table with Iran just as those sanctions were starting to bite. The administration says we couldn't have kept it up much longer. The other countries supported sanctions at the UN to bring Iran to the table. Once Iran was willing to come, we had to talk to them. There are some companies that have informally agreed to cut their oil imports, like India, South Korea, Japan. They were tired of doing that, and that we basically had no more time. But I think that that's a point, you know, that is we'll never know. But that's one of the stronger counterarguments, I think.
Let's go to David, Dayton, Ohio. David, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Well, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yes.
I wanted to shift your track a little bit, talk about history, because I think we forget that from time to time. Citing first France in the 1960s, where the United States hemorrhaged huge amounts of money to not develop the bomb. They went ahead and did it anyway. We had deal after deal after deal with North Korea. They developed the bomb anyway. We begged India and Pakistan. They still have the bomb. We're great allies with Israel. You know, they never admit it, but they have the bomb.
So what's the lesson of all that, David? What lesson do you take from that?
Well, the point that I was getting ready to make was if a country is resolved to get the bomb for one reason or another, they're going to do it. And it shouldn't maybe be a question of how do we keep them from getting the bombs? How are we going to treat them after they get the bomb?
But where does that leave you on the deal? Are we right then to make a deal or not?
That's hard to say. I would definitely be an advocate of making a deal with normalizing relations and stabilizing the area. Certainly Iran is a problem in that they are taking, you know, great steps to keep the area destabilized. And, you know, I it might be important to look at the interest that is, you know, what is in Iran's interest. Certainly they want to be a bigger player at the table. They want to sit at the big kids table. And in their mind, getting the bomb is the way to do it. And it has been with everybody else who's developed the bomb.
The president says they won't have it now. We'll see. Hillary Clinton says in the text version of her response to the deal that they'll never have it, that that's her position. She's going to stick with that pretty clearly through the campaign season. Bill in Iowa City. Bill, you're on the air. What do you think?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I'm a retired Marine, and I applaud Kerry's commitment to diplomacy, and I, too, have seen the horrors of war. And I applaud the whole deal. And one of the things, it seems like the most of the fiery opposition from Netanyahu and the Republicans is against the 15 years when the restrictions come off. There's going to be four presidential elections between now and then. If the Republican president wins and has a majority, he can do whatever he wants to kill the deal. So it's kind of funny to see their approval that they're acknowledging that it's going to work. And I think before the 60 days is up, the United Nations sanctions are already going to be taken off. So it's kind of the horse will have already left the barn by then.
Bill, I appreciate your call as well. Garance, here's another one that's going to play out through the entire campaign season. And I wonder how you see that working to the Democrats' advantage, to the Republicans, how in the primary, how in the general?
Well, I think it's clear that the American people have been tired of war and United States military involvement overseas for some time. That said, there is also, I think, a sort of growing concern over the destabilization in the Middle East, the fact that the Arab Spring there and the sort of peaceful revolutions there did not wind up settling things. You know, Libya is kind of a mess right now. There's just a great, there's continuing war in Syria. And so it's going to sort of play against that backdrop where people will also look at whether they can trust that what the president and the Democrats have said is going to happen in the future will happen, based on the fact that some of the things that people were predicting might happen in the Middle East have not really come to pass. The Republicans are absolutely going to be, you know, taking this deal and using it to appeal to the more conservative and militarily conservative parts of the GOP base, who are much more significant in the primary season. Obviously, Clinton, as a former member of the administration, is going to be defending the deal. I mean, she has people working for her who were, you know, part of early negotiations. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, we're going to see that play out. But I don't know that it's going to wind up being the main issue in this race, in the primaries. But we'll definitely hear a lot of talk about it during this period where things are unsettled in Congress still and people can weigh in.
And Michael, what about the U.S. and Israel? If this deal goes through after such harsh and instant condemnation from Prime Minister Netanyahu, I mean, this has not been an easy relationship with the Obama administration in any case. But what about these two countries on the other side of this deal, if it indeed goes through, as it looks as though it may?
Well, Tom, as you know, that's been a very troubled relationship for several years now. You know, there are a couple ways to think about it. One is that, the relationship can't recover from this, that Obama and Netanyahu have had so many differences. There's real personal dislike here. And at this point, the Israelis are counting the days until the next administration comes in. You know, there may be another school of thought that says at least we can get this off the table. You know, you have the deal. Once Congress votes and is assuming that the president is able to sustain it, there's not really much left to say except to watch Iran and make sure that the deal is implemented, but that maybe the relationship can move on. We can get past this argument. We will have to agree to disagree. You know, that could be optimistic. The last thing I'll say is, you know, Grant's made the smart point earlier that many voters aren't familiar with the details of what's in this extremely complex agreement, and I think they'll be taking sort of larger cues, seeing the debate framed in kind of simplified ways. And I think there will be part of the partisan argument will be, you know, that this is all about Israel. You'll see Republicans leading strong with the argument that this is dangerous for Israel's security, that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu hates the thing. And you're going to see voters reacting to that because that's something that they can really grab onto. Israel doesn't like it. So is this bad for Israeli security? I think that's an unfortunate way to have this debate because it's kind of simplistic. And there are a lot of senior Israeli officials who disagree with Netanyahu, but that could be where we're headed.
Jack, does this in some way, if the two countries just split on this, does this somehow take Israel out of American politics if there's just a break and it's not going to be resolved?
Well, it's always going to be there simply because, as Michael said, it's such an effective issue, or at least it's thought to be. I mean, I think that Hillary Clinton's caution, for example, in the initial statement on Iran and her statements otherwise on Iran, I attended a speech she gave up here last week, is in part tacking toward the state of Florida. You know, she's got some idea, some eye on voters down there who'd be moved to vote on the basis of Israel's security, so or at least a concern about that. So, yeah, no, I don't think there's any avoiding it in American politics.
Her message in the print response, the message to Iran should be loud and clear. We will never allow you to acquire a nuclear weapon, not just during the term of this agreement, never. Maybe speaking to that quadrant. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. In other news this week, Colorado theater shooter James Holmes, we mentioned him, was convicted on 166 counts yesterday in the 2012 attack, left 12 dead, scores wounded, no insanity found. Robert Sullivan, grandfather of six-year-old shooting victim Veronica Moser Sullivan, said he fully expected the verdict.
Only an insane juror could find otherwise. You could not come back with any verdict but guilty.
NASA's New Horizons spacecraft sent home the first close-up look at Pluto on Tuesday. Operations manager Alice Bowman and her team got the signal.
Copy that. We are in lock with telemetry with the spacecraft.
And Serena Williams won her 21st Grand Slam title at Wimbledon on Saturday. She spoke on the court after her big win.
I can't believe I'm standing here with another Serena Slam, so it's really cool. You guys helped me get through it. I heard all you guys. I heard all the I love yous. I love you more.
What a career, and it's still going. We're looking a week in the news. Iran deal, Chattanooga shooting, Harper Lee, Greek bailout, El Chapo is out. Scott Walker is in the race for the U.S. presidency, officially. Garance Frankie Ruta is with us from Yahoo Politics, editor-in-chief there. Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico, is here. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us. The president off to Oklahoma, visiting El Reno Federal Correctional Institution there, talking with reporters, expressing disappointment here that Americans could adjust to living in a country with such a high number of incarcerated young people.
I think we have a tendency sometimes to almost take for granted or think it's normal that so many young people end up in our criminal justice system. It's not normal. It's not what happens in other countries. What is normal is teenagers doing stupid things.
And they're not all young anymore. Some long sentences there. Really campaigning on this week. With the NAACP conference, Philadelphia, on Tuesday, the president talked about inequality within the prison system. He said locking up nonviolent drug offenders has left a disproportionate percentage of the prison population African American.
In far too many cases, the punishment simply does not fit the crime.
Jack Beatty, a president in a federal prison, an African-American president, talking about this groaning wait, and now Republicans and Democrats both on this front. Does the dam break at some point here? Do we turn around? Or is it the, what I saw a Republican called it, the leniency industrial complex at work?
It looks like we're turning around. John Boehner asked yesterday, well, what do you think about the president's visit, and are you on board with sentencing reform? He said, absolutely. I have long thought, and so on. So, yes, we have reached a moment of crystallization here for all sorts of reasons. You know, politics do change, and they are an instrument of change. I remember in the 90s when, boy, people were talking about super predators, and Joe Biden was pushing a crime bill and Bill Clinton was pushing mandatory sentences.
Lock them up.
And that was the mood of that day. But now we have the lowest crime rate in many years, apparently, and the trend seemed to be down. And this seems to be a moment when suddenly politicians can't demagogue in the usual way on crime, so now they're actually sounding enlightened.
Garance, what are you hearing on the campaign trail? What do you expect in the campaign season ahead? Could it be that there'll be a consensus on this, or will it be irresistible to treat it as a wedge issue?
I think we're in a really extraordinary moment where there is an emerging consensus that there is a need to reevaluate our relationship to the criminal justice system and how many people we lock up and how many people we give records to and how many people wind up in jail, even for just a couple of days, how many people wind up arrested who never go to prison, who still have this contact with the criminal justice system that really derails their lives, that this is an economic issue. If you have this many people, especially when they're young, having contact with the criminal justice system and being marked by it and having their lives upended by it. It was extraordinary to have the president go there. He said, there but for the grace of God.
Could go many of us if we had, you know, screwed up as young people and taken the wrong path for a minute.
I mean, I think most people, if they look back at their lives, can think of something that they did that is technically not legal. The question is, who winds up interacting with the criminal justice system over this. And now there's a movement afoot to take some misdemeanor crimes and to make them administrative civil issues rather than misdemeanors, so that people are having to pay fines rather than having to be threatened with arrest warrants or potential jail time, as a way of taking some of the people out of the system. But I, you know, Rand Paul has been active in this earlier in the year. He's been a little less visible recently, but I think there's just a really fascinating consensus at this moment in time, which is only possible because the crime rate is low. If the crime rate were high, if the sort of increase in murders we've seen in some big cities, if that really turns into a thing that concerns people again, if there's a major increase in crime, we will, I think, very quickly see consensus on this disappear.
Of course, a very different prison story across the border in Mexico, causing tension between the U.S. and Mexico this week, and no small amount of distress within Mexico. You had Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, super drug lord, headed out of that mile-long tunnel. Nobody could believe it. Sort of the hole produced in his shower, a ladder, a motorcycle, tracks and ventilation and lighting and the whole bit. Here was Mexico's Interior Minister Miguel Angel Osorio Chong saying there had to be corrupt help on the inside, interpreted here by Reuters.
Tuvo que haber contado con la complicidad de personal y o...
It had to have happened with the help of personnel or officials from the Altiplano Social Rehabilitation Center. Confirming these facts, they constitute an act of corruption, disloyalty, and a betrayal of Mexicans, of institutions, and members of federal forces.
Michael Crowley, a little interpretation here. We saw really high tension between the U.S. and Mexico in the aftermath of this. But at the same time, there was a sense of almost inevitability about it. Yeah. What does this do to relations, and will we ever see this guy again?
Well, you know, we may see him again because it's very obscure trying to understand which drug lords are captured in Mexico and why and who gets to escape. And one imagines this, you know, hidden, dark, complex matrix of money and power and influence and murder kind of determining these things, the winners and losers that seem to get picked to some degree by the government. But, you know, it's a severe blow for the relationship between U.S. and Mexico. There was already mistrust. The new administration of Enrique – let me step back for a second, Tom. I went down to Mexico and I profiled the new president, Enrique Peña Nieto, who took office in 2012. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's been a lot of fanfare. He passed some major reforms there and has opening up the economy, opening the oil industry to outside investment, and really trying to bring Mexico up a notch, you know, socially and economically. But as long as there is not rule of law in that country, none of that is going to work. And if they open up the oil industry, there's not rule of law, it's going to be plundered. So, you know, what we see here is an amazing kind of Hollywood thriller style story about one escaped drug lord. But the bigger picture here is this very sad story in Mexico where rule of law is not prevailing. The drug money obviously buys wild influence. There's endemic corruption in the government. Voters there are very disillusioned with Peña Nieto. And it's sad because the country has a lot of potential for a lot of reasons, a lot of economic potential that might surprise people that don't follow close attention. But as long as there doesn't seem to be rule of law and, you know, and a government that's not corrupt, the country is not going to move forward. And it's a very sad story. And it's bad news for America because they're right on our border.
It is sad indeed to see Mexico stuck on that problem. Law and prisons on both sides of the border as an issues this week. Mildred, Lexington, Kentucky. Mildred, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I had a comment about prisons. The system, the justice system, is horribly flawed in many ways. But one of the things that I don't understand, the prison is supposed to rehabilitate people, but they can't be guaranteed to be safe. They're in prison. They're subject to being brutalized. I don't understand how we're supposed to help people or anybody choose to get away from that life when they are in danger in prison.
Yes, and that is an issue that has not been solved and certainly hasn't been solved as the populations there have grown and grown. That and more on the president's mind as he visited the prison this week. And I appreciate your call, Mildred. Our time grows short. We've got to look at this big settlement with Greece. The Greek people voted in a party that said they would never do this. They would never accept terms like this. The hammer came down. Greece had little choice. Its back was really against the wall. And ultimately, its Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras signed the deal. Here he was speaking through an interpreter on Greek television. This was Tuesday. The Greek prime minister addressing his reluctance to accept the bailout deal, but saying, I've got to do it.
It is my responsibility that I signed a text I do not believe. However, I am obliged to implement this text.
And here is the European Central Bank raising its emergency funding to Greek banks. And you've got the president of the Central Bank, Mario Draghi, saying Europe may still have doubts that Greece can meet its side of the bargain, even now, after that apparent capitulation.
No matter whom you talk to, there are, I would say, questions about the implementation, will and capacity. And so it will be, that's what I said, it will be really in the Greek government capacity to respond with policy decisions, with actions that would dispel these doubts.
Michael Crowley, is this story over, or might this deal still not be accepted somehow? And what about the internal state of Europe after this? Talk about sad. This looks sad as well.
Yeah. Tom, I don't think the story is over. Certainly not this chapter, but certainly not the larger question. This appears to be, you know, in effect, another punt. There are a lot of people who think that, well, I would say, first of all, that there are an increasing number of people close to this situation who think that the short-term deal is not going to play out and we will be back on the brink of crisis soon enough. Even if it does, there doesn't seem to be much optimism that they've really found a tenable solution. I mean, I think that, you know, the best that a lot of people think has happened here is they've averted one deadline and they will muddle through to the next one and hopefully find some better solution. But, you know, it's a real blow to the dream of European unity. You know, Germany's finance minister is still articulating the idea that it may be the case that Greece has to leave the Eurozone, and that would be, you know, a tremendous setback for Europe and this European Union project and the Euro project, but just absolutely devastating for Greece. The human toll there is only going to get worse. I mean, it's going to be kind of a lagging indicator. So I think that we're just going to see, even if some kind of deal is worked out here in the next couple of years, terrible, heartbreaking stories of suffering in Greece. And I don't know how to cap off my thoughts here with some therefore answer. I just don't know what's going to happen. But I think it may well get worse before it gets better.
We're going to talk on this show in this hour on Monday about Germany after all of this and the sort of bully label that's been put there these days, Germany's role in Europe on the other side of this. Scott Walker in the Republican field, 15 now in the race for the Republican nomination for the presidency. Donald Trump in at least one poll, leading pretty clearly with only Jeb Bush even close to him. But here was Walker coming in his campaign announcement speech Monday. It was criticized, among other things, the new Iran deal, saying he would turn it all around if elected.
We need to terminate that deal on the very first day in office, put in place crippling economic sanctions on Iran, and convince our allies to do exactly the same thing.
Might be a tall order, but there's the vowel. Garanz, Frankie Ruda, how does Scott Walker look at this point in the long campaign season?
I think he's extremely well positioned for someone who just formally entered the race. He has been leading in polls in Iowa for a number of months, despite not having been declared. And he is immediately shot up to number two nationwide. Now, I just want to make a note about these national polls that show Donald Trump in the lead. In 2012, over the summer of 2012, Herman Cain was in the lead in national polls for the GOP primary. In 2011. In 2007, we had, you know, other candidates who were in the lead.
Their portraits do not hang in the White House.
You know, Rudy Giuliani is not the president of the United States. Yeah, yeah. Herman Cain is not the president of the United States. The national polls right now are largely meaningless, except for as a example of who is getting national exposure. Now, Trump is definitely speaking to something within the Republican Party, and what's most fascinating is the way in which other candidates are declining to contradict him because they worry, A, that he might launch a well-funded independent presidential bid, drawing support from their eventual candidate. And also because, you know, he does have some support within the primary base. Scott Walker has been reluctant to speak up against Donald Trump's remarks on Mexicans and immigrants, for example.
And so there we have Donald still dazzling the cameras and drawing that attention. I think we all discount the polls at this point, and maybe all the way through, given how everything's evolving here. Jack, what do you see in the Scott Walker candidacy?
Well, you know, in Wisconsin, he took more moderate views than the ones he now espouses, and this has raised questions about the authenticity or even the existence of his convictions. He is, however, authentically middle class, and when he talks about, as he did in that speech, about clipping coupons to buy $29 shirts at Kohl's, that sounds real enough to many Americans. You know, President Obama beat Mitt Romney by nearly 60 points on the question, which candidate better understands the struggles of ordinary people? On that crucial dimension of electability, Scott Walker might outscore Hillary. We were dead broke. Clinton.
Even this week with her more populist economic message, Jack?
It certainly sounded like a rich menu to raise American incomes and sort of save the middle class, and she's found her feet on economics.
The measure of our success, Hillary Clinton said this week, must be how much incomes rise for hard-working families, not just for successful CEOs. But $29 shirts from Kohl's, I don't know how many of those are hanging in the closet in the Clinton house. Well, hey, everybody's got their path. Jack, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Garance Frankie-Ruda, editor-in-chief at Yahoo Politics. Thank you so much, Garance.
Thank you.
And Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Always great to have you right here, Michael. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Tom. Thank you.
Listeners, good weekends to you. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be right back here next week. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.